You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. I am Matthew Raphael Johnson, who founded this series of lectures many years ago. And we are at the very beginning of December 2023. Like I say every week, those of you who have donated to me, either directly or through Patreon or in some other way, Cash App or Bitcoin, whatever it might be, I thank you because, as I say, you're the reason that I have been able to maintain my intellectual independence and to be able to do this for so long without having an institution, a university or a church or anything like that behind me in terms of financing. Today I'm going to talk about something that's at the very core of what I do here and what I've been doing for several decades. We're going to talk about the Russo-Ukrainian idea, which has been at the heart of my world for a very long time. And it's caused no great degree of comfort. Quite the contrary. Specifically, I want to get into the Russians living in Ukraine and using an article from Nazarov, published some time ago, among others, come to the heart of what's really going on in this war. Everyone's kind of focused on Israel now, and I don't like simply following what the media is telling me is important. I want to go to things that are basically evergreen, as we used to say at the Barnes Review, things that may touch on current events, but only because it's making a far broader point. And what some people don't realize is that the heart of the Russian nationalist movement prior to the revolution, that is to say, the Bolshevik Revolution, was in Kiev, was in Ukraine. This is where the Black Hundred was heavily concentrated in their resistance to the revolutions of 1905. And many of them, of course, became part of one or another of the White Armies. So many great bishops came from that region. Metropolitan Vladimir, Metropolitan Anthony Klapovitsky of Kiev and Galicia. And you also had the Kiev Organization of Russian Nationalists. You had many extremely pro-Russian movements there. And I want to say, as important as it was in certain respects, the Ukrainian nationalists, not necessarily the separatist movement, was fairly small. They made very good points, which is the whole point of my book, Ukrainian Nationalism, which you can get on Amazon, among other places. And I don't completely reject them. It's a balancing act. But even Galicia, the turn of the 20th century, was a hotbed of Russian nationalism. That's where the Russophiles came from, breaking away from the Uniate Church. I've dealt with them quite some time ago. What I don't think I've stressed enough in the past is that when the Bolsheviks won against the White Armies, as well as the pro-Ukrainian, but also pro-Russian hetman in Kiev in 1918, said to be supported by the Germans, in other words, being propped up by the Germans, which is simply not true. It's hetman Petro Skoropadsky, who is related to other hetmans with the same last name, Skoropadsky, and I've dealt with him separately elsewhere, and I always look to him and to Nikolai Gogol to help shape my point of view. So many of the, whether it be the Cossack nationalists or the intellectuals in the 19th century, were not necessarily anti-Moscow. They certainly weren't anti-Russian. They may have dislike the Petrine state. And of course, decades later, rejected the Soviet state. And that's where you get quite a bit of confusion, because there's a Soviet attack on Ukrainian separatism and all that that implies. Then you have a traditional Russian Orthodox attack on the same phenomenon. And while we agree on many points, of course, our foundations are completely different. My biggest critique of the Putin government, as great as it was in so many areas, is that it continues to base itself on the so-called Great Patriotic War. And even these very firm National Socialist governments in Eastern Ukraine and elsewhere still use Marxist symbols as if somehow that's amenable to Russian Orthodox nationalism in Russian areas. Having a picture of Stalin next to one of Tsar Nicholas II doesn't make sense, but I've seen that. And because of that strange dichotomy, you don't have really successful Russian nationalist movements in Ukraine. We're going to get to that here in a minute. But when the Bolsheviks took over, created the Ukrainian SSR, for a time, they violently promoted the use of Ukrainian. Now, that went away, but to solidify their rule, they took Ukrainian symbols, no different than Western liberals do today, and without much understanding, these are mostly Jews, who either hated it or just didn't understand it at all, manipulated these symbols to gain a foothold in parts of Ukraine at the time. Not its current borders. That waited until World War II, but, you know, initially, this is what they did. And in fact, Russians living in Ukraine, being as firmly nationalist as they were subject to greater repression than in Russia itself. But it didn't matter, because over the decades, you had tens of millions over time of Russians or Muscovites in Ukraine retaining the Russian church, retaining the Russian language, straight up through the dissolution of that state, that empire, years later. And this is where things get dicey. The stronghold was in the Ukrainian Orthodox Church, the Moscow Patriarchate. I'm not going to get into the problems with the MP. I'm very bored of that. Novices can talk about that all they want. We can't really, I mean, some of these details are very picky, and there's no excuse for talking like that in this era. We're looking squarely at life and death here. But that hierarchy, for better or for worse, was one of the most important bonds of Russian nationalism and the Russian nation in Ukraine. The Union of Orthodox Brotherhoods, of course, the Black Hundreds, they were extremely important prior to the revolution. But the power, the movement itself of Russian nationalism was greater in Ukraine than anywhere else. But after the fall of the Soviet Union, you did have anti-Russian tendencies growing, even within the UOCMP. There was a counteraction of separatist tendencies from the Moscow Patriarchate, because the autocephalous, again, I have much sympathy with some of those leaders. Again, that's also you can't paint them with one brush here. And they were extremely, some of them were extremely provocative. But of course, it's a very bad argument, and I disagree with the Union of the Russian People in this, to talk about the metropolis of Kiev being transferred from Patriarch of Constantinople to Moscow in 1686. And I've gone on and on and on about why that really wasn't canonically legitimate at all. Once Ukraine or Little Russia came from under Polish or Turkish occupation, there wasn't much legitimate about it, and it was done entirely by bribery with a Patriarch of Constantinople, which was about as Orthodox as Bill Clinton. the Ukrainianization initially of parts of Eastern and Central Ukraine early on was seen as a Soviet movement. Now later, after World War II, you had today's very artificial borders of the Ukrainian SSR. And it really was in 1990 that Patriarch Alexei, said that the former Ukrainian exarchate will then become independent in its governance within those borders. Now, people like Nazarov make a big deal about those borders. I admit, very much like in Africa, the borders do more harm than good. But it's how you're going to redraw them. Even the Organization of African Unity said, we're not going to mess with these borders. No one's going to be happy. No one's going to be satisfied. And it's the same thing here. Although I think partition is going to be the final end of everything there. Calling them Bolshevik borders, well, that's a matter of history. Borders can't be Bolshevik or not. As far as the Soviets could gain at the time. Ukrainian did become the official language. And at the request of parishioners, depending on where they were, that language was used instead of Slavonic. And there was absolutely nothing wrong with that. Even when Crimea became independent, or actually, I shouldn't say independent of Ukraine, eventually part of Russia, they maintained themselves within the Ukrainian Orthodox Church of the Moscow Patriarchate. Now, again, I've dealt with, I can't believe he's still alive, but so-called Patriarch Filaret Denisenko. He's still alive. He's in his 90s. I think he's 94. He's still filing lawsuits. I mean, he is a demonic entity. Patriarch Vladimir did not like him. No one trusted him. He was KGB at one point. But the minute he didn't get his demand of becoming Patriarch, he went to Ukraine and did it there, becoming vehemently anti-Russian. Of course, he does have a Ukrainian name. And once he was defrocked, I mean, they tolerated his wife and child and everything. But once he was defrocked, he gained some authority here. And we all know that once the Soviet Union fell, it was really a crime how the Moscow Patriarchate didn't provide a proper spiritual assessment of the nature of the USSR, let alone something like, you know, the Sergian-based loyalty system to it. Yes, they supported the new authorities to some extent, especially after 2000. But at least in the 90s, they came from that same 1970s Leninist background. And because of that lack of any real rejection of the Soviet era, which you know, put them in a terrible position, it permitted the autocephalous and the separatists to refer to the Moscow Patriarchate, no matter how, or, you know, where it was or what it did, as simply a Soviet institution that functions like a Soviet institution. The great crimes of Ukrainian intellectuals, including those I respect, is deliberately using the word Russian when they really should be using Soviet. But when so many of these, like, you know, Soviet nationalist types in Eastern Ukraine tried to combine both of those things, Ukrainians could take the high ground and condemn this, well, it's a Russian nationalist movement that uses a Soviet basis. And it is, you know, and so this has real-world ramifications. There was a backing of Yeltsin, the great criminal revolution, as we call it, alienated a lot of people from the Patriarchate. And it's unfortunate, as much as I love the true Orthodox Church, so many of them they've split so badly, and they hate each other so much, including the synod I was a part of that fell apart the minute the Metropolitan Damascene died, as I knew it would, that their witness has been muted for that reason. They have some large organizations. You know, I'm not going to make these distinctions like I used to. Orthodox struggling is bad enough. So many of these divisions are personal. You had to have been there. There's no way to objectively assess it. I do this full time, and I could, you know, it's a constant battle. And there is the argument, and this is, again, probably the second biggest criticism of the Putin government, is that they were not engaged. Moscow was not engaged with Russian nationalists in Ukraine. The Union of the Russian People under Nazarov is a wonderful organization, but they're way too hard on the Russian president. It's easy to criticize. I mean, we all do this, of course, when you're not there making decisions. Putin has always erred on the side of caution. Most of the time, that's a very good thing, but sometimes it's not. And as Russians began to receive violence, not just in, you know, in Ukraine, but elsewhere, Putin's actions were slow in coming. And it's true that in the early part of Putin's reign, maintaining good ties with the West was the priority. But in Ukraine, the 90s, the 2000s, and certainly in 2004 on, Russian media, Russian institutions came under pressure from the American-backed government there. Of course, 2014 was the year of the American-backed revolution in Kiev, and only in Kiev. That dealt a huge blow against Russians. And it culminated in the mass murder in the Odessa House of Trade Unions, May 2nd of that year, which was fully accepted as somehow democratic by the Western world. Soon, and certainly as the war started, but the war really started in 2014, increasing bans on the Russian language is what forced the existence of the Russian Spring. That's the uprising of Russians in regions where they had a majority, which were many. And it became the foundation of Novorossiya, which I have made the centerpiece of so much, you know, what I've done over the years. There's a huge flag, Novorossiya flag, in my office. But very much like the U.S. and the Hungarian Revolution of 1956, which was abortive, Putin did promise soldiers on March 4th of 2014. And I can quote him directly here. He said, "If we see that this chaos begins in the eastern regions, or if people ask us for help, and we already have an official appeal from the current legitimate president, then we reserve the right to use all available means to protect those citizens, and we consider these perfectly legitimate." He did have a request from the president. Yanukovych was anything but perfect. He was very iffy. You know, I have an old piece on his political thought. No one's ever done that before. And I recognize the negatives. He has far more negatives than Putin ever did. But it didn't take long for those in Crimea, with a referendum, bloodlessly took control of that peninsula from a dying Ukraine. There were punitive forces there. They came under the guise of vacationers, sending them in large numbers to start smashing up the state that they were in the process of erecting in eastern Ukraine. And then, despite the fact that sanctions were already present, the Kremlin was worried about any more of them and would rather recognize that revolution rather than fight it. The Minsk agreements, at least according to Nazarov and many others, were an indirect acceptance of the revolution in Kiev in 2014. When they created the Donetsk People's Republic and the Luhansk People's Republic. And of course, they had many referendums justifying their point of view. No one was shocked at the results. Putin also said that maybe they should try to solve their problems within the Ukrainian state, which is such as it was, which was a terrible thing to say at the time. But again, always erring on the side of caution. Russians in Donbass and elsewhere refuse to capitulate. And I've been through this at length as to why. But I've always found it odd that from 2014 to this very day, doing everything they can to destroy the Crimea, to put a water blockade, transport blockade, an energy blockade, such as it would be from Kiev, and then systematically shelling eastern Ukraine from 2014 to the present day, is hardly a way to try to bring them back to Kiev's orbit. The only reason they're coming, they want to bring them back into Kiev's orbit, is to destroy them. And either to drive them out, or simply murder them. And they've done a pretty good job of that already. But you had legitimate heroes, despite some of their Soviet foundations. Igor Strelkov, I don't know, Valery Bolotov, Evgeny Zilin, Paul Dremov, people like that, many of whom lay down there, you know, were killed for this. And most of these were done in assassination and with terrorist attacks on civilian centers. And it's unfortunate that Soviet patriotism took over from Russian nationalism, giving, again, Kiev, at least for a time, the moral high ground. Part of this is how Kiev was initially successful in whipping up this anti-Russian concept. Because like so many in America, they've convinced people that Russian nationalism is really Soviet patriotism. And in 2022, the Council of the Ukrainian Orthodox Church declared its full independence from Moscow. Again, this is just seen as a sign of weakness because Rada simply passed a law to ban it. And then that, of course, pushed some Russian, you know, the true anti-communists, as they might be called, to over-dramatize their anti-Russian points of view. And some of you know who I'm talking about. So many Russians in exile, the fragments of the Synod Abroad or the Synod in Exile, are to this day promoting disinformation. There are several very important websites that I love that have the Ukrainian flag on them, buying into the Ukrainian propaganda, the movement called the Forces of Good, or the Good, marching together with all anti-Russian forces, claiming that Russians are against the war with Ukraine, the new wave of political immigration, as people like, I think his name is Dmitry Sovin, who left for Latvia. But, you know, Sovin, even Vladimir Moss makes those kind of statements against and over Russia. I haven't read him recently. Now, this is not Leonid Sovin, who's a friend of mine, who's a good man. I'm not talking about him at all. This is another one. And he wrote this in an article called, I think it's called They Exist, on the Mazepa webpage. I'm not sure why. Anyway, and here's what he says. And this should sound familiar to you. Ukrainians are not a fiction. They're not a disease. They're not propaganda. History has developed in such a way that the Ukrainian national project has taken place, reaching its final completion in the fire of the current war. This is an objective reality. Denying it is harmful to mental and physical health. Ukrainians exist. This is already a different nation, a different state. And what was before is gone. We must admit this. And for all intents and purposes, let Ukraine go. Now, that does sound somewhat familiar, although he draws the completely incorrect conclusion. I don't know what let Ukraine go means. Let it go to what? That's, of course, the main issue. What he doesn't understand, of course, is that Ukraine is not an independent country. Kiev is an American colony. It exists exclusively from aid. And if there's another loan package, the IMF knows they'll never see this again. It doesn't matter. They're willing to go broke almost, sending billions to this country. Of course, you know, one set of bankers gives it to their friends in Kiev. I guess it's not that big of a deal. It's not going to stay in Ukraine. We all know. But at least you can say, for all the evil, overcoming the Soviet legacy in Kiev, that's one thing. But that has absolutely nothing to do with hating Russians and bombing positions in states that left the fourth world hellhole of Kiev, Ukraine. So the false dichotomy is that either you're a Soviet patriot or you're a Ukrainian nationalist. Part of my book, Ukrainian Nationalism, came out, I think it was in 2018, 19, something like that. I can never remember. Was designed to challenge that. That most of the great Ukrainian nationalists were in the middle. They were not separatists. Panteleimon Kulis being one of my favorites, and certainly Gogol. But even beyond that, the narrative, the official narrative in Kiev, again, has very little to do with Ukraine. This is a Jewish oligarchy with American backing. who used the symbols. Can you imagine Cossacks living under a liberal Jewish regime? That was their entire purpose, was to smash that wherever it might be found. But they'll use the symbols. I remember the first time I saw Yushchenko with the Hetman's mace. What a blasphemy. What a sicko. Any of these people, these Jews with the Hetman's mace as a symbol of their authority, when in fact the point of the Hetman's mace was to smash them over the heads with it. But the way that the borders are today, of course, Ukraine did not exist this way until the 20th century. There are millions of Russians living within it. And there was a campaign against the Russophiles in Eastern Ukraine, Western Ukraine, which were many. Yes, they differ in historical experience and to a lesser extent the culture and language. There's absolutely nothing wrong with this. I have challenged the idea that there's one source of Russian identity. There are several. One of the errors of the Ukrainian national movement is to claim that the Mongol, they believe are Asians, which is idiotic at this point, that the Mongol occupation altered radically the nature of Russian political thought, and it did not. This is simply the realities of what it was like to rule a state the size of Muscovite Rus. And the concept of Little Russia, that's not a diminutive. You know, Little Greece and Great Greece, and this is, I think I've said this before, Great Greece was the Greeks in Italy. Little Greece was actually Greece. There were so many Greeks in Sicily, because that's where the Spartans were, and in the coastal areas of South Italy, quite a bit inland too, there were more Greeks there, so it was called Great Greece. And this is why I started off today talking about the dominance of Russian nationalism in Kiev in the waning days of the empire. I've questioned the idea if the Mongol horde was in fact Asian. I have no evidence that that's the case. There's far more evidence that they were in fact Slavs with some Asians from Central Asia. You know, they're the predecessors of the Cossacks, so to speak. And I've taken very seriously the challenges both to the Norman theory of Russian origins as well as this, you know, Kiev flowering after its destruction into the rest of Russia. It's not a easy arrow from A to B. But the Bolsheviks did create the Republic of Ukraine in the 1920s, the Ukrainian SSR. That took its final form at the end of World War II. And one of the reasons for it was to divide and weaken the one group of people that they hated, the Russians, and the second, the Ukrainians. Because of the Cossack attacks on the Jewish oligarchs in the 17th and 18th century, you have this, and you know, the Hasidic Jewry being, you know, born and raised in Ukraine, in the old Polish Empire, they despise the image of the Cossack. They despise both the Ukrainians and the Russians, really, as being two sides of the same coin when it comes to the possible reestablishment of Rome. So this war suits them just fine. The American government at the elite levels, of course, the financial establishment. You know, I have, if you take the Wikipedia page on the list of Jews in finance in America, it's 22 single-spaced pages. And that's just what they have on Wikipedia. And those are just the major institutions. They're 2% of the population. You have a phalanx of BlackRock Jewish operatives, both in Kiev and in Washington. It's from one set of Jews to another. Like it or not, it happens to be the case. But the traditional Russian narrative that I unfortunately bought into in my very first book, it ignores the Cossack republics. It ignores the Cossack Hetmanate and the Cossack state in Ukraine under the great Hetman Skoropadsky, as I mentioned before. But declaring the Ukrainians a nationality that has a separate foundation from Russians is equally problematic. They differ in many respects. It's very difficult for me to translate something in Ukrainian to something Russian and vice versa. But it's not that much more difficult. So the successors, you know, the successors of this regime legitimize Ukrainian independence within those borders. The Ukrainian government that took over after independence, slowly but surely, as they completely went from a, you know, the typical second world state to third and now fourth world state, as that's going on, eradicated its Russian heritage. The things that unified them rather than divided them, not helped by the fact that the Russian movement tended to be Soviet. At least the old 70s, you know, 70s version, not the 20s and 30s version. The Russians were declared an occupying people, an alien Asiatic minority, despite the fact that back in the 90s they made up half the population. Let me quote myself here. In my book, Ukrainian Nationalism, here's what I said. Ukrainian independence has been a travesty. The Orange Revolutions have had no relation whatsoever to any school of Ukrainian nationalism. So to see their apologists in the West try to fit the round peg in the square hole is a little humorous and sad at the same time. In no way can any of this be permitted to sully the thought of Bandera, the Ouyanov, and Franco Tarasenko. Ukrainian nationalism cannot be associated with the cosmopolitan, oligarchic, capitalist, and nihilist morass that has reduced one of the world's industrial powerhouses to its present fifth world status. The Orthodox Church cannot be associated with the likes of the secular, materialist, and opportunistic Patriarch Filaret. Most of all, Ukrainian nationalism cannot be associated with the nihilists such as Poroshenko, Timoshenko, or Yushchenko. Of course, I wrote that many years ago. So we're talking about two very different things. Just like you're talking about two different things in the Russian resistance, both the Soviet patriotic and the true Russian nationalist and royalist, so too you have at least two completely different movements. Taras Shevchenko would have spit on what's happening in Kiev. But you also have international law. Now, you know what I think of international law. It's there at least, at most, for symbolic purposes, to rhetorically appeal to it. But if the regime is going to occasionally cite international law, well, we have things like the UN Charter, the European Convention on Human Rights, which is a joke most of the time, the Convention on Protection of National Minorities from the Council of Europe, many, many others. What the Russians have done in Ukraine and what's been done to them is, on the one hand, very legitimate, and what's been done to them, very illegitimate. Any state exercising the right of self-determination, the means of exercising the right of self-determination, may be the establishment of a sovereign independent state, free accession or association with an independent state, or the establishment of any other political status. Even if it's at war with the territorial integrity of the state, but if it's aimed exclusively at protection from external aggression, it's a different story. So in the principles of international law, nothing in the actions of states, and I'm quoting here, shall be construed as authorizing or encouraging any action which would tend to dismember or to impair in whole or in part the territorial integrity or political unity of the sovereign independent states, observing in their actions the principle of equality of rights and self-determination of peoples. Now, of course, that's going to be cited when you're talking about the state within a state and these migrants from the third world, not, however, to Russians in Ukraine. Now, they're well aware of this. Again, you don't tell them, oh my God, your policies are contradictory. They know that. They don't really have principles. So the point is that the territorial integrity of any government is not applicable to a state that actively represses minorities of long standing. You know, Romanians in Hungary, Russians in Romania, whatever it might be. Thousands of Russians have been killed deliberately. All Russian schools and media closed. Russian language in public places banned. All of this and more was applied to the Russian population, included in the Ukrainian SSR by the Bolsheviks by force. And yet the West, who wrote a lot of the, you know, the Western elite, the regime who wrote a lot of these words, finds Kiev to be a completely democratic state, despite it being one party. If there's anything, it's a dictatorship. It's a military government there, or the junta there. Now, whether the military will take over and shoot the president of Ukraine is anyone's guess. You know, the Cossacks should probably take over if they had the strength to do that. Putin not recognizing the referendums in the Donbass right away was a mistake. And the Crimea was a different story. But for 8 years, the shelling of the Donbass cities occurred to and on almost exclusively civilian targets, including the use of cluster and phosphorus weapons. The social infrastructure was completely destroyed long before the war started. Tens of thousands were killed, all of whom were civilians. It was the Kiev revolutionaries that started this war in 2014. But just to show that there are no principles, you know, the regime, the global ruling class, liberal ruling class, to show that they have absolutely no principles, you know what happened in 1999. The crimes, so-called, that they accused Milosevic of were extremely minor by comparison to what Kiev has done. I mean, not even just, you know, keeping it to the burning of the activists in Odessa or the punitive anti-terrorist operation, which were far more violent than anything that Milosevic ever did. But Ukraine is still a freedom-loving, democratic country committed to the values of civilized European community. But because of public ignorance, the Kiev revolutionaries can use the Jewish media to begin blaming Russia for all of this, public ignorance being what it is. But it was just in 2022, the governments or the foreign ministers of Germany and France both admitted that the goal of the whole Minsk process, the agreements, was to buy time to arm the Ukrainian revolutionaries, more so than any kind of peace, which means everything they said concerning that was a lie. There is no question at this point that a massive Ukrainian invasion against the Donbass was being planned for the spring of 2022, and those plans were in action or were cooked up in 2021 at the latest. Remember, the recognition of Ukrainian independence within the borders of that Ukrainian USSR came from the Budapest Memorandum in late 1994. Ukraine, Russia, Great Britain, for some reason the USA, contains a clause in this memorandum that you can take military action against Kiev or its allies if the terms of the memorandum are violated. I've talked about what petrol mines are, shelling cities, destroying an area and then claiming the Russians did it, knowing full well the media is just going to repeat it without criticism, without asking any questions. They do place artillery in residential areas. These are Russian-speaking areas in eastern Ukraine. Human shields, that's exactly what the Ukrainians have done. They always accuse you, project what in fact they're doing. One of the reasons that the Russian advance was so slow at first was to minimize civilian casualties because they were all, as we know from the referendums, pro-Russian. My God, Kiev was distributing weapons to criminals released from the prisons. And of course, anything that happened, they blamed on Russian agents. Just like Stalin in World War II, the Kiev revolutionaries said they're not going to comply with the Geneva Convention, at least when it comes to POWs. Nazarov mentions Gennady Druzenko, who's the head of the mobile hospital project. He called on, of course, on the Ukrainian side, he called on Ukrainian doctors to castrate and kill Russian prisoners, saying that they're cockroaches, not people, which is a direct quote from him. There's videos on the internet that the Ukrainian soldiers have posted, when there were such a thing as Ukrainian soldiers. They posted videos and, of course, said this was the Russians. Anyone who watches it, they don't know the difference between a Ukrainian and a Russian uniform. Believe it or not, throughout this period of time, in the Baltics, you see it in the Baltics, you see it in some people in Georgia, the U.S. NATO claimed that the Russian Federation is preparing an attack on Europe to destroy the world. Of course, they said that about everybody that they don't like. dissenters, such as myself, especially in Europe, are repressed as being Putin's propagandists. I want to quote Mikhail Nazarov, who I've written about substantially on this topic. He says, "No longer disguised as in the Cold War, but an open Russophobic tsunami of the current scale is not even designed for the possibility of its reversal. Otherwise, all the politicians and propagandists participating in it would have to admit that they were disgraced slanderers who repeated lies despite its proven refutation, and accomplices of Ukrainian war criminals who massacred their own civilian population and are subject to trial. Russophobia, in other words, anti-Russian hatred, is not a hidden aid to the war, but an open military operation on a global scale, which is a necessary psychological artillery preparation, so to speak, for the destruction of a clearly defined enemy, and that's Russia. And this is not a military matter, but it is being done in a military style. It's a political matter. The army is shaped, especially by its ideology, by the supreme commanders. Still, Russian military is associated with the Red Army. The great victory of the Second World War, which did nothing but prolong the existence of the slave-owning Stalinist system. That somehow that's a sacred battle. And blatant falsification of history. But when the war started, the first few months, you had these demoralizing negotiations, gestures of goodwill, retreat from liberated territories. And then when the Ukrainians took over, they killed the inhabitants because they had voted for the referendum. Unequal exchanges of prisoners and everything else. And it took it way too long to bring in reinforcements. It seems that, and I don't want to push this too far, but it seems that Putin still held out some very, very, very naive hope for reconciliation. Now, I think that's probably history. It took a very long time. Again, he's always erring on the side of caution. We're entering an era of history where that simply can't be done. But there's three reasons why Russians and Ukrainians in the late 20th century have been cast as opposites, when, of course, nothing can be further from the truth. The first reason is, I've hinted at it already, it comes from the USSR. By eventually creating this very large Ukrainian state that was permitted to be somewhat Ukrainianized, you know, as a price for loyalty, plunged them into spiritual catastrophe. Yet with good reason, the Reds saw the Black Hundreds, whether then or now, as their main enemy and sought to destroy them. Ukrainian nationalism was to some extent a reaction to this. But referring to the Soviet Union as this united entity in some kind of positive sense is completely fraudulent. Number two, I'm going to quote Nazarov. He says, "In the post-Soviet period of independence, Russia gave up all of Ukraine, 40 million fraternal Russian souls to the global Kahal. This Jewish elite that made enormous efforts to instill Russophobic mythology and hatred of Russia in Ukraine." Again, Moscow simply too cautious in this regard. I think Moscow, Putin, and others started to believe the Western press about its own invincibility. Of course, we know that that's absurd. I've been saying this for many years. It's going too far to claim that the Kremlin abandoned the Russian population there. But action was slow and very much delayed, years ago at least, to develop trade ties with the West. In other words, the United States, NATO, they penetrated Kiev, all the holes of power there, using their NGOs and corporations to build a column of fighters for their purposes. Russia did not do that. Number three, even after all this, Moscow continued to try to live in harmony with not just the United States, but the revolutionaries in Kiev too. He acted too late to assist what we call the Russian Spring. Yeah, it's true. Moscow sent equipment, advisors, humanitarian convoys. But Kiev received much more than that. And don't forget, for up until the war, Kiev was receiving subsidized oil from Russia. Just continuing to hold out this hope which, you know, if I'm ruling this, I can understand. But in trying to avoid a war, he made it almost inevitable. The USA was clearly preparing Ukraine as an anti-Russian NATO springboard. As sick as that is, he did recognize the revolution and accepted the Minsk agreement in the hopes of weakening Ukraine, creating a fifth column there. But the US, we all know, was not going to support that. Like all victorious movements, the ideology has to be strict and firm, sacrificing numbers for the sake of unity, which is exactly one of the main reasons that the Bolsheviks won against the whites. Now, hindsight is 2020. Of course, had he done something in the spring of 2014 with a legitimate request from the ousted president of Ukraine, yeah, the world would have been better off. Many years later, or last year, 2020, February of 2022, neither Putin nor writers like myself took into account how much money was poured into a now fourth world Ukrainian state to build a first world military that sticks out like a sore thumb. Famous Brzezinski and his grand chessboard said that the war for Russia, specifically Eurasia, is the main prize for America. And finally, to forestall an invasion, Russia entered the war against the U.S., NATO, and Kiev in 2022. But Kiev has nothing to do with Ukraine, not ideologically, certainly not racially or ethnically. They installed a Jewish comedian, almost as a quite literal way to mock us. And their only concern is, other than survival, destroying as much of Russia as they possibly can in Ukraine and outside. The start to the war, the special operation, was almost gentle, incompatible with rules of military action. But of course, I've spoken of that dilemma. An operation like this can seek to limit their own casualties, limit civilian casualties, and maximize the destruction of their enemy, but they can't do all three at once. That's a rule of not just counterinsurgency, but of warfare in general. If you want to destroy your enemy, you're going to have to take both civilian and military casualties. Putin underestimating not just Ukraine, but the Western assistance, how far the West was willing to go to abandon its own defenses for the sake of this. He certainly underestimated that, but also trying to minimize casualties in general allowed Kiev, who does not operate according to the rules of war or the rules of anything, a chance to move in. Of course, their supplies and everything was destroyed, you know, this time last year, if not more. The Russians have refused to demonize their enemy, which I understand from a racial point of view, but again, Kiev, having no real connection with Ukraine, the government there, it is American, doesn't follow those rules either, to the point where they can claim that Russia is the source of all world evil. And you have some dumb American patriots saying the same thing. And this greatly helps the builders of the Great Reset. And what drives me crazy, and I've said this before about Putin, is their obsession of trying to go on and on about fascism and neo-Nazism. Just pure historical illiteracy. This fixation of the Great Patriotic War. Even going so far as accusing Germany of trying to build up this fascism in Kiev. Zadov talks about the Ukrainian language textbook for schools in the liberated territories. Still has that same Soviet stilted language for the Second World War. You can't have the so-called patriotic victory on the one side and true Russian nationalism and orthodoxy on the other. It doesn't work that way. Their bases are very different from one another. Ukraine isn't some alien land as far as Russia is concerned. Now, I said the same thing that Gogol and so many other Ukrainian writers said, that Ukrainian independence works if and only if it is orthodox and allied with Moscow and Belarus. Then it makes sense. But since Moscow didn't move very quickly to have its people in Kiev, the U.S., the NGOs, the corporations did a much better job. They were in a much better position, especially over the last 20 years. Maybe not today. And it's these American leftists that are condemning the Ukrainians as fascists and all that. Well, that's not what they are by any means. If that were the case, they wouldn't be at war with Russia. And they certainly wouldn't be working for what we used to call the New World Order. Yeah, so on the one hand, you know, right-wingers can see the Ukrainians smashing statues of Lenin. That's great. But they do so because they see them, believe it or not, as Russian imperialists. No different than Tsar Nicholas. Again, pure historical illiteracy. Even in their editions of Gogol's works, they just stupidly replace words like, you know, Russian land or Rus with Ukraine, which he did not say. The old saw about the Aryan Ukrainian language being enslaved by Asian Muscovites is believed by, you know, people who I know today. It was believed by Hitler, although the Table Talks book says that a lot. He doesn't say it anywhere else, but to buy into that nonsense is to, for Orthodox people, to reject the mission of the Third Rome. Rome, of course, is the very opposite of Talmudic Judaism, resisting world evil. The Kievans today act like janissaries did, especially near the end of the Ottoman Empire. You know, the occult pagan, you know, Azov Battalion, and the bizarre videos that they have put up. At least a small or a sufficient number of Ukrainians have been deceived, even brought to demonism, doing things with corpses of killed Russian soldiers. You have people like Tymoshenko, Ferion, Yurosh, Kuczynski, and all the rest openly call for the destruction of Russia with NATO's nuclear weapons. As the Jews in Ukraine ban the Orthodox Church, unless someone like Filaret runs it, they're not going to, under this condition anyway, not going to eventually become ashamed of their hatred for their brothers. Now, these crazy, they're not Ukrainian nationalists, whatever they are, Azovites, they never did well in elections. But rejoicing the murder of civilians as their actual object, doing things like blowing up the Crimean Bridge, how is that going to help anything? It's not even appropriate to talk about two fraternal peoples fighting each other. What's happening in Ukraine is a huge victory for demonic forces, including the Talmudists. They took the second largest Orthodox state in the world and turned it into, at least at the elite levels, the most hostile entity of all the neighbors of Russia, and the main springboard for the regime to continue to wage war on Russia. And the only real purpose, deep down, the theological purpose, is to prevent the restoration of the true restrainer. And for all of Putin's faults, he has served that role to a great extent, especially, you know, many of you have heard his speech. I think it was Tuesday this week. We know that the consequences of any American victory, and it's not going to happen in Ukraine, especially now with the Israeli nonsense, the marching of the Great Reset will be almost irreversible. Building the Third Rome, in whatever imperfect form it may take, is dependent on the victory in and possibly the partition of Ukraine. Any victory any support for the Ukrainian-American forces there is merely bringing Antichrist closer. Any nationalist, you know, those support, I mean, you know, I have nothing but respect for Ukrainian nationalism. It has to respect others, especially those of a specific national identity within its borders, especially as close as Russia and Ukraine. But this self-deification, this belief that they're not like the Asiatic Muscovites, this inferior race, it's utter nonsense. The majority, and I've talked about this before, I've cited too many sources, the overwhelming majority of Ukrainians do not accept that. The great victory, of course, has been to destroy the Soviet legacy. That's fine. But that has nothing to do with what's going on now. Russian people should have their historical land returned since the atheists are the ones that gave it to them. Decommunization is not the same as destroying these Russian occupiers. And a wildly exaggerated conception of Ukrainian history. Russians have fought the new wave of Ukrainianization, which has been absolutely frenzied. This isn't a war for Ukraine. This is a war of the Great Reset. Ukrainian independence is fully justified on cultural, political grounds, so long as the brotherly feelings in the Orthodox Church continue to unite them. For it to become a stronghold of Orthodox forces resisting the regime, the dehumanization of the world, but the exact opposite is happening. The Kiev government, having nothing to do with Ukraine, is in fact serving the Antichrist. Russia being the Antichrist, really, their only enemy. And that's a very ancient doctrine. The Minister of Defense, this is about 6 months ago, Reznikov said, and I quote here, "You're fulfilling NATO's mission today. They don't shed their blood, we shed ours. So they are required to supply weapons." Of course, he's referring to the West. Suddenly, the Western media is very concerned with defending Europe. Ukraine in almost a Jewish mode of the eternal victim of Russian aggressors. The Third Rome, however, was created by the common ancestry of Rus-Ukraine, which Ukrainian supporters of Kiev, they're not nationalists by any means, have abandoned entirely. What has this independence given Ukraine, other than enriching the billionaires, the Poroshenkos and the Kolomoyskis, exclusively Jews, abandoning everything, the total destruction of the Ukrainian economy since 1991. Who's to blame for this? Not the Russians, who subsidized that economy as best as they possibly could, as it's been stolen and destroyed by the oligarchs. Yeah, they recognized the Bolshevik borders, but what else were they going to do? You have to separate anti-Soviet thinking from anti-Russian thinking. They're completely different. The Soviet Union had nothing to do with Russia, except simply exploiting it. The Russian Empire desperately needed Ukraine, and Ukrainians were an elite group in Russian society, and hence were very loyal in many ways. Only the Soviet patriots deny the Holodomor. It wasn't the result of corrupt failure or the consequence of peasant uprisings. It was a deliberate policy of starvation. That has nothing to do with Russian imperialism. None of them were Russians. Russian people were the first victim of the communist regime and resisted it continuously, both within and without the country. Whether it be Soviet, American, any kind of anti-Russian interpretation of World War II completely obscures it. It was the preparation for what we call the New World Order and today the Great Reset under the BlackRock monopoly. He says, "Satan seduced you," and he's talking to Ukrainians here, "Satan seduced you not into a war against the Czechist Putin, but against historical Russia, the Third Rome, and he seduced you for a long time. But among the Orthodox people, even in today's Russia, there still retains a hope for the restoration of the monarchy." And it's the only justification for Ukrainian independence. Belarus has been perfectly fine in that regard. The revolutionaries in Kiev are extremely unpopular, even without the war. Dragging the country to fourth world status in just a few years, that by itself, you can lay it right in the hands of Jewish oligarchs, colonial dispossession, certainly foreign influence, which of course, you know, the Americans, the NGOs did far better than any of the Russians did, showing exactly how, as you remember a few years ago before the war, how any movement of a Russian convoy over the border was called a Russian invasion. I could show you newspaper articles proclaiming the Russian invasion 2017, 18, 19. They said it over and over again. Anything, any act of Moscow in favor of the Russians in the eastern half of Ukraine and elsewhere was called an invasion. There's no satisfying these people. Russian nationalism in Ukraine has always been essential. But the lack of timely support these days, prior to the war, the intense repression from Kiev since at least 2004, plus the Soviet patriotic idea of so many of the Russians in Ukraine, it's allowed Kiev to take the high road. So many of them were unable to understand the sources of this Ukrainian ideology that exists only in the city of Kiev. Anyway, I think I made my point today. It's extremely depressing. And all I see is simplistic slogans, wild oversimplifications, and a total lack of functional knowledge concerning what's going on here. The intense pressure that Putin and the Moscow government has been placed under really since it came into existence. I still don't believe that the bulk of Ukrainians like this policy. I think they're terrified. Everybody in Ukraine has lost a friend or a son. By now, I don't think anyone is. You have a national PTSD, and the regime is taking advantage of that. Thank you, as always, for listening, and I will talk to you next time. Bye-bye.